Welcome. I'm Jessica Teigen, and this is the Evolving to Exceptional podcast, where we talk about reaching peak performance in our workplaces, homes, and communities so that we can live our best life possible, an exceptional life. I want to welcome back our listeners to this week's episode of the Evolving to Exceptional podcast. Today, we have with us Dr. Frank Douglas, who's the founder and CEO of Safe Haven Dialogues. He has spent most of his career in the space of science and global working with global pharmaceutical companies and leading those organizations. He has an incredibly powerful background and years of experience, and he's written a number of different books, including his latest, which is Until You Walk in My Shoes, which I can't wait to get my hands on and read myself. So, Dr. Frank Douglas, I'd love for you to tell us a little bit more about yourself, about what, why you do what you do, how you got to where you are, and what important to you?
How I got to where I am is probably the place to start.
Sure.
I was born in Georgetown, Guyana, which was British Guiana at that time, and came to America at the age of 20 to go to college. It was in 1963, about 8 days before Dr. Martin Luther King's march on Washington, where he made the famous statement that he hoped one day that his children would be judged by the content of their characters and not by the color of their skin. And why this is significant is that when I arrived, I came on a Fulbright scholarship. I was on an orientation program at Yale for the Fulbright fellows and scholars. And the third day into it, I actually experienced what it was like to be judged by and to be discriminated against because of the color of my skin. I went on to Lehigh, where I got my bachelor's, and then to Cornell, where I did both a PhD and an MD. And after my PhD, I actually worked for a year and a half for Xerox. And if you would permit me, I'll share with you a story that happened at Xerox, which really is probably the beginning of why I do what I do. I was there 3 months, and during that time, those first 3 months, I could not get a good project. And one day, a young white man joined the group. He had not completed his PhD, whereas I had. And within 1 week, he was assigned to what was the most attractive project we had in research and development at Xerox at the time. I went to have yet another conversation with my manager and was getting the usual excuses. When I suddenly said to him, "Steve, don't think of me as Frank. Think of me as though I am Bob." And I was actually stunned to see the awareness come across his face as he said to me, "Bob has only been here a week, and I've put him on the Ardrey project." I was furious. I ran out of his office, down to the office of the senior vice president, to give him yet another example of how I was being discriminated against. Well, about 2 or 3 years later, I reflected on that incident and realized that I had actually missed two very important things. The first was that Dr. Tribus, the senior vice president, had hired 3 young Black PhDs that summer to join the 1 Black PhD that Xerox had in research and development at the time. So it probably was more important to him that Frank Douglas would do well than it was to Frank Douglas. The second thing that I missed is what I call my desired outcome. My desired outcome was to get on a good project. It was not for the senior vice president to have difficult and tough words with my manager. So had I reframed the question, and had I said to Tribus, "Could you help my manager find me a good project?" That would have happened like yesterday. He was 3 levels above my manager. Just imagine, him walking into my manager's office and simply saying, why don't you find the man a good project? Could have been done yesterday. About 5 years ago, I was writing my memoirs and I was writing that incident when it suddenly occurred to me that what I had been doing is what I had learned from that incident. And when faced with the incidents of discrimination thereafter, I was reframing, finding a better problem to solve, to get to my desired outcome. Why do I do what I do? 2020, I was sitting there, as many of us were, looking at George Floyd being murdered and looking at the people on the sidewalk trying their darndest to get Chauvin to take his knee off of George Floyd's neck. And I began to wonder, if George Floyd had been taught how to reframe, could he have avoided getting into the situation he was in the first place? So that led me to set up a group, which I call Safe Haven Dialogues, to really focus on individuals facing issues of discrimination and to help them to employ the process which has helped me, namely the reframing process.
That is such a powerful story. And I just want to thank you for your vulnerability and sharing that your past experience and challenges that led you to where you are and your willingness to really step into a space that and a need that is clearly a challenge in the world in general, but certainly in the world of the workplace today. So tell us a little bit about how you do that. How does Safe Haven Dialogues, what is part of that discussion, and how do you provide that framework or that method for how to address discrimination?
Two things are very important. The first, as we reflect again on George Floyd, there was one person who was being killed that day. And as I reflected on my own episodes of dealing with the discrimination or helping others to deal with discrimination, there was always an individual involved. And although many organizations have been very diligent and have been doing a great job with DEI, many times we focus on getting others to be sensitive. We try to improve the environment. And often we forget the individual. So the first thing we focus on in Safe Haven Dialogues is on the individual. The second thing is that I feel very strongly that every organization, including the family, fundamentally is based on two things, equity and inclusion. Equity are the policies and the rules that are set by the leaders, the parents, and how this organization, this family will operate to get the results and to achieve the goals they would like to achieve. And inclusion is how the colleagues, the co-workers, the frontline managers agree to behave with each other, to value each other, to recognize each other, and to work together to achieve those goals that were set by the leaders. So we focus on equity and inclusion. The other thing we do is that often when an individual has been complaining about being treated unfairly and not getting any real response, they often feel they're not being heard. And you would hear this all the time. No one is listening to me. They're just not hearing me. So one of the things we have done is we've put together a panel. We call them our VIPs, victors over injustice in their professions. These are individuals who have faced discrimination, have been successful in dealing with it. And we have the aggrieved individual present his or her case, their case, to this panel. They know immediately that they will be heard because this is a panel who understands their pain. So they will be heard. They will further be heard because of the process. We do two things. The first thing we do is we ask the individual to describe their problem, their situation, in a format which we use. And the format asks them to start off by telling us what is their desired outcome. As in the story that I told you, my personal story, I had not reflected on what my desired outcome was before I reacted. And it's natural to react when we are faced with difficult situations, but then we have to stop and step back and really ask ourselves, what is our desired outcome? We ask them to describe the situation, the environment, and their view of the problem. But the key thing is we ask them to do that all in bullet form, not in paragraphs. When we write paragraphs, we wax lyrical, we become authors and poets, etc. Just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. You're probably not old enough to remember Dragnet, but there was this very famous detective Friday, who on interviewing individuals will say, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. So to get them to step back a bit from the emotion and to state just the facts. Now, when that case is presented to the VIPs, they focus on issues around equity and inclusion in that case. And we put together what we call our equity inclusion culture matrix. Because one of the things that is very clear, an organization may write on their website and write in their annual report all the wonderful things they are, that indeed their employees are their number one asset and on. But then you find individuals who are experiencing a very different culture from that which is described. Mm-hmm. So the focus is to really understand those issues of equity and inclusion being faced by that individual. That's the culture they are in. And then given that, we have a process where we go through to help them to find a better problem to solve. In my case, a better problem to be solved was to have asked Dr. Tribus to ask my manager to find me a good project. That was a hell of a better problem to solve than the one I placed in his lap. My manager is discriminating against me. What are you going to do about that? And so that is the process. And it enables then the aggrieved individual thereafter to have the type of dialogue that would be productive with their manager to come to an improvement in their situation and in the environment in which they are.
I really love that the steps that you took us through there. And the thing that sticks out to me is how helpful I imagine it is for those that are impacted to be able to, like you said, feel seen and heard and be able to move through some of that emotion so that then when they do go to present their challenge or their issue, all of that emotion isn't right there at the surface coming up and coming through, that they're able to work through some of that so that they can deliver that message maybe in a way where it's more likely to be heard. Has that been the result or the effect? Can you give us some examples or maybe some situations or folks you've worked with and how this has helped them create a different outcome or a different result?
Yeah, example. The book actually describes 18 cases, interviews, and we go through those 18 cases. The first example we give is actually a composite of two cases. And we did that because it allowed us to show more aspects of the process in that case. But I will mention to you the situation that JA, we committed to maintain the anonymity of these individuals. So we use initials and false initials, actually, to try to protect them. But JA is of Moroccan descent, works for a small company, been there about 20 years, felt very committed to the company. The company had helped him get his visa, work visa, and has a 17-year-old daughter who's looking to go off to college shortly. And during the time he was there, he started off as a mechanic, actually got his bachelor's and a master's in project management. suffered a lot of indignities, particularly about 10 years or so ago, where he was called camel jockey and camel head, towel head rather, and things like that. And people said, oh, they're just making fun. They didn't mean anything about it. There was an opening for a project manager position. He applied and did not get it. He was then asked by his manager to help the person from the outside who was hired, who was not that strong in project management, to assist that person. Now, when we asked JAA what was his desired outcome, things like he would like to see this company be intolerant of discrimination at all levels, and he would he had three desired outcomes. One was to be recognized for his achievements. One of the things we pointed out to him is that he was actually being recognized for his achievements, because the manager had asked him to help the new hire. So the manager recognized his achievements. And what he really wanted was for his peers also to see that his achievements were being recognized. So what if we did the following? Having complained that you were passed over, etc., what if you had a different discussion? What if you went to your manager and you said, elements of project management is very important for what our group does. I would like to give some lessons in the afternoon after work to those who would like to learn elements of project management. It's very unlikely now that your manager will say no to that. When you start giving these lessons, you're now achieving what you wanted to achieve, a desired outcome, to be recognized for that expertise. Now, you can have further discussions with the manager once that is established, and you've established now a relationship with this manager that is more positive, in which you can say, this is going to help the productivity of the group. And there's another thing that could help the productivity of the group. And that is if people were to treat each other with respect and not to call each other's names. Would you mind having a session and helping us with that? And so that was one of the approaches. So the better problem for him to solve was not the one he was embarked on. How does he get this culture to be more sensitive to minority groups, but rather to look at his other desired outcome, to be recognized for his achievements, and to actually use that as a way to get to his other outcome.
That's a really, I think, helpful example to show how a shift in mindset and a shift in thinking can change what a person pursues or what avenue they pursue to create change. How do you see the next step then? So if he's taken that step to create that recognition of his capabilities and his skill sets, how does change ultimately come in terms of the organization if the original decision truly was a discrimination-based decision, or there is that kind of systemic discrimination within an organization or a workplace?
We have to be realistic. If it is systemic, we know it's been there for years. It's not going to be changed overnight. That's one. Secondly, he had complained to his manager, and his manager's manager had gotten no response. So we would say, when you look at the equity inclusion matrix, is that pursuing things along the equity line, namely with the leaders, is not likely to be successful. So focus at the level of inclusion of your work unit. And if you begin to get changes there, and particularly one of the things we focus on is improvement of productivity, because no manager will argue against productivity. And you begin to get improvement in productivity because not only has your motivation improved and increased, so has the motivation of your work colleagues. You demonstrate that productivity then that is likely to move very slowly, perhaps, but it will move through the organization. And so one has to be realistic and not to think that one episode is suddenly going to change an organization that has been behaving in a certain way for many years, for something which is now endemic and systemic. We have to be realistic.
I think that's a really pragmatic and measured response to help create change that will have a ripple effect. I think it's a really interesting and thoughtful strategy to help individuals really respond within the environment that they're in to create more successful results for themselves, especially because in my experience and in working with others, often when discrimination issues are raised, especially in significant or high profile ways, the outcome is rarely good for the individual themselves. Often it means they end up having to leave the organization. Even if it does create change, it creates a break in the relationship that isn't really repairable. And I think I really like the idea that you're empowering people for how they can take ownership of and create change without necessarily having to negatively impact the situation that they find themselves in.
Yeah, what we like to say is that we look for the small levers that can help us make the macro changes, but focus on those small levers. Many years ago, when I was a young manager, and Stephen Covey was one of those authors whom I really, and leaders in management that I read and studied, he had in one of his books a diagram, which I still use, I share with people, but I use the back then frequently at the time. And he had this diagram. There were two circles. The larger outer circle was labeled area of concern. And the smaller inner circle was labeled area of influence. And he remarked that most people work in that larger area of concern, where, as a matter of fact, they have very little influence or capability to make any changes or to affect anything, rather than working in their area of influence and then growing outwards into their area of concern. And so a part of the process really captures that intent. To start working in your area of influence, which has to do, in the case of JA, here is a capability you have. Here is your work, a unit in which it can be useful. That capability is already producing benefit for your manager and for the new hire and for the group. So that's your area of influence. So we talk about, when trying to find a better problem to solve, what are your points of influence? What are your areas of influence?
I love that. And one of my predecessors, one of my mentors early in my career, was also a big Stephen Covey fan and proponent. And I think it's a good reminder that the most important work starts right there within us and within ourselves and then those that are right around us versus trying to change the nature of everything. And really, again, I feel like you're really empowering people to be able to take action that has an impact on them immediately. And I'm curious, what is some of the impacts of that or the benefits of that on people's well-being, on how they're doing and how they're able to continue to live and work in that environment?
I think one of the most important studies that have been reported this year, a group from Boston University reported a longitudinal study they had done, I think, in 20,000 Black women whom they followed for about 20 years. And what they discovered is the group of women who reported significant incidents of discrimination in their workplace, in dealing with the police, in housing, had 16% greater incidence of heart disease compared with the other group. And one of the things we actually do not really recognize, and although we know it, but we don't really pay attention to it, is that stress in the workplace does not remain in the workplace. We take it home, and it impacts our relationships at home. Yeah. So this whole issue of the importance of stress and the stress caused by discrimination, the impact on the well-being, it's very important, and unfortunately, it's not really recognized.
Yeah, and I don't have to tell you this as a medical doctor and given your background, but for our listeners' sake, certainly that stress and that the effects in terms of the heart and the correlation there is really around that stress being stored in the body and it impacting people's heart rate variability and their ability to tolerate stressful situations and life challenges in general. And over time, under that extended stress, it relates so highly to medical consequences and heart disease and other long-term illnesses, autoimmune conditions, and other medical impacts because of the effects of that. And certainly being in discriminatory situations are going to leave that impact of stress. Are there recommendations that you have for individuals that are enduring those situations of how to do so in a way that can help to protect the longer term consequences or to help them navigate those situations in a better way?
What we are offering actually is indeed a reframing process to make them, one, conscious that there's something that they can do about it. The fact of the matter is that stress is worse when you're in a situation in which you feel that there's nothing you can do. Mm. It is worse. And one of the things that we know is that with stress, cortisol is released. And with continual stress, you get a continuous overproduction of cortisol. And that leads to a number of things, to heart disease, to diabetes, to weight gain, to increase in blood pressure. And of course, the specific incidents, we then get an increase of the sympathetic nervous system. Catecholamines get released and in the moment, the blood pressure is increased over time, that remains elevated. What we recommend to individuals is that, one, if they're in that situation, don't deny it. Recognize that indeed that they are in it, because so often one of the ways we deal with stress is denial, is to recognize it. Also to accept your anger. You're angry about it. The trick is not to stay in that state a long time. It's to then ask, what are the opportunities within your own environment? Does your HR have an EAP program, for example? What in your particular environment could be helpful, and reach out and take advantage of that? Don't be embarrassed that you are in a situation that is stressful. There's no reason to be a hero dealing with your stress. There's nothing heroic about that.
I think that's so helpful. And one of my missions, one of my passions and purposes is really around creating training and awareness of that nervous system regulation and how to navigate stress. And I think most people don't have an understanding of how to regulate themselves, how to bring themselves back into a healthier, more balanced state. And without that knowledge, it makes it more difficult to navigate when we get into those sympathetic fight, flight, or even the freeze type states in our lives of how do we bring ourselves back to a state where we can be more functional and more productive.
Did you just say freeze state?
Yes.
I tell you why. Oh, this is wonderful. In one of the cases, it's a case of a physician who is being really badly treated in the hospital. There was a misdiagnosis, and she's a physician. And we could not understand why she did not exhibit the other reaction, namely fight or flight. Mm-hmm. But rather really froze. And it led me to think of many situations in which I had seen that. And it's so wonderful to hear you say that, because we talk about fight or flight, but there is another response, which I call the freeze and be feeble. Mm-hmm. There is that response, and we do not talk about that. And it is quite real.
Absolutely. And I think in my experience in studying it and understanding it, I think it's pretty common. And it's actually even harder to move out of a freeze state. In a fight state, in a fight or flight state, we tend to actually fight. We get that energy out in some way. We have an argument. We do something. In a freeze state, we can hold that within our bodies and within ourselves for a really long period of time, and it can do a lot of damage.
Yeah. No, this is. I'm just so glad to hear that, you know, someone who studies this actually is looking at.
And we don't talk about it in the workplace context. And really, from my perspective, I actually believe a large part of the quiet quitting that we hear about in workplaces is an example of the freeze state.
Yes.
Of people going into simply, I can't run away from this and I can't fight it. So I'm just going to disengage from it. And I'm going to not put as much effort in. And really, it can be incredibly damaging and detrimental to the folks that are in that state to stay within it and not move through the emotions like you talk about with the clients that you work with and the method that you have, because it's in the moving through those emotions that will release them from that state and from the suffering that they're enduring.
No, absolutely. And in fact, we talk about the situations when one is in a culture that is very low in equity and low in inclusion. That individual is very distressed. And there are times when that individual simply has to leave that culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Or face the negative consequences.
Or face the negative, yes.
Absolutely. And I think the study that you pointed out and the background there of the effects are indicative of the damage and the consequences to not just the individuals, certainly the individuals, but sometimes I think we overlook the effect that's actually having on our organizations, our cultures, our communities, our families. Yeah, absolutely. And so all of that is going to have an impact that in a lot of cases, I think leaders are just ignoring or not even aware of.
I think it's a combination of both. I think many times they're not aware. And when they are aware, they feel helpless. They do not know how to approach this. And for them, it's a Pandora's box that they'd rather keep closed.
So why do you think that is? Why do you think they'd rather keep it closed?
Because we have, basically, we are very uncomfortable dealing with human issues. We can deal with each other when we are talking about, did you count X number of widgets? Yeah. It is not that comfortable when we go, how are you feeling today having done X number of widgets? And we have this discomfort really dealing with difficult situations, dealing with others' pain, dealing with our own pain. And so we just try to avoid it. And so there's a lot of avoidance.
Do you think you've been a leader in multiple organizations and in workplaces and businesses throughout your career? Do you think it really is like the last part of what you said about dealing with our own emotions that is keeping that Pandora's box closed?
Yeah. No, I do believe it. I do believe that individuals who are comfortable with their own vulnerabilities, are comfortable with looking at their own weaknesses, and are comfortable with acknowledging those and recognizing we are all, as we used to say, the largest room in the world is the room for improvement. And when it comes to these human issues, this is a very large room. Those individuals who feel comfortable recognizing that about themselves are then in a position to accept that in others and to hear others' pain and to empathize with others' pain. And the thing about it is that others recognize when a leader feels their pain, when a leader understands, and when a leader is hearing as opposed to just presumably listening.
Is that
what
you...
What makes the difference?
What would you recommend to leaders who are wanting to create more equitable and inclusive workplaces, who are wanting to create environments and instill a better approach to these challenges in their organizations? What are your recommendations to them?
My recommendation first is know thyself, and to thine own self be true. That's the first recommendation. The second one is, in everything that we do best when we're working as a team, and we do best when we surround ourselves with individuals who have the strengths and other capabilities that we do not have. So that's what you do. You bring together in your team individuals who can indeed fill out those other aspects of the human need in the workplace. And they don't all have to be HR people. They have to be individuals who have that sensitivity, who, as they do, whether it is their chemistry or their genomics or their mechanical engineering, that they have that sensitivity to others. And so you make them part of the team so that when a human issue comes up, you can get a perspective from that engineer who also is empathetic.
So if people want to work with you, work with your organization, or go through this kind of process, how do people work with you? Do you work with just individuals who are facing this? What are the steps for them to get engaged with you and your organization?
Two things. We do workshops for organizations. And we also do one-on-ones. And if they contact us, our website is www.safehavendialogues-llc.com. safehavendialogues-llc.com. Or if they send a letter to team@safehavendialogues-llc.com, we will get back to them. And we are happy to do a demonstration webinar. It's free to demonstrate how this works, to engage in a one-on-one conversation on the individual needs. And we are very happy to coach individuals in the reframing process that is specific to their situation.
I think you're offering just a tremendous resource for individuals with a challenge that I think often has people feeling cornered or trapped, like they're not sure what to do to navigate it without, like we talked about, potentially blowing up their career or having to start all over in a new setting or new workplace. And so you're offering, I think, really a constructive avenue for people to navigate their emotions, their experience, and potentially create a better outcome for themselves, as well as maybe beginning to start to create those small ripples of change that might have a bigger lasting impact as they're able to work within an organization rather than have to leave it in order to bring about change.
Yes, absolutely.
So is there anything else you want to share with our listeners? Any words of wisdom or thoughts that you have before we wrap up today's conversation?
Yes. One thing I would like to share, which has been helpful for me and something as I did many of these interviews and I've talked with people, has become very clear. As so often when we say equity and inclusion, they sound like such, they're multiple syllable words. and to think of equity simply as that which, whether people are being treated fairly, whether processes are transparent and are being applied fairly across the board. You see what your prospects are and whether there's a relationship between the performance you have and the achievements and the rewards that you get. So equity is what, how are the policies actually that are written, how are they actually being implemented? And inclusion is what you feel. When you raise your hand in a meeting and you're frequently ignored by the leader of the meeting, you feel that. No one has to tell you're being discriminated against, you feel it. Or when someone insults your tribe, your group that you're a member of, be it ethnic, be it gender, be it sexual orientation, and they throw out an insult, you feel it. You don't have to try to analyze it. Inclusion is what you feel, and equity is what you and if you think about those two things that way, it becomes easier to identify what is happening to you in your culture.
That really resonates with me, because in my past, I was in an organization that had some challenges in this space. And one of the things I think is hard for those that don't feel the lack of inclusion, right? So there's those that are experiencing it. So you do, like you said, you really feel it. You just know it. You feel the effects of it. And for others, it's really hard for them to see something that they themselves are not feeling and experiencing. And I, at one point, I was developing a group of high potential leaders, and that was something that they struggled with very much, was being able to see or appreciate an experience that they themselves had not had or felt themselves. So I appreciate that kind of example and the difference between something that is felt versus the equity that is the systems and what people see and what exists there. And just because the systems are there doesn't mean that the behaviors aren't creating a lack of inclusion, that the behaviors aren't creating a different result, even if you believe you have the right equitable systems.
Absolutely. And in fact, it's part of why the process is also designed in such a way that it gives the opportunities and for organizations to have their leaders play the role of the VIP and walk in the shoes of the aggrieved individual. Because when you walk in the shoes of the aggrieved individual, that's when you begin to get an opportunity to feel. But until you take that walk, if you haven't taken the walk before, it's hard to feel it.
How do you do that? How do you accomplish the walking in the shoes of someone? How do you take leaders through that? Or what are the steps of that?
I had a very, in fact, it was really quite interesting. It was a wonderful workshop. A group reached out to me from the Society of Information Managers. And they said, our CIOs, we don't think we have discrimination problems, but we have a lot of problems with conflict resolution. And we've been looking at your method and we think it could be useful. So we discussed and I said, send me a couple of cases. I had not thought of it that way, but there are elements that I think make sense. To, as we say, cut a long story short, we had a workshop. And the members of the workshop, they played the role of the VIPs. So we went through the case and they had to identify, this is a conflict in one of the things. I said to them, realize that invariably in conflicts, there is a bias, either conscious or unconscious. And as a matter of fact, because of that, there are many things, particularly in the inclusion space, that are being overlooked, and also in the area of equity. How are the processes? What's available? I said, when you first approached me, I thought, okay, I would need to change that language to something else, but it turns out to be not. So as they went through and started to identify those elements, they were getting the ahas to get to what was a better problem to solve for this conflict. And one of the issues of a better problem to solve, incidentally, which I did not mention specifically, is that the solution for that problem is not only a solution that helps the aggrieved individual achieve their desired outcome, but it must also improve the situation of their work group. And there they will get the buy-in, and this is why the situation becomes better, because if the problem they have solved also has improved others in their work group, they have accumulated even more allies, and that work group improves.
Yeah, that's such a powerful process for creating awareness. And I'm curious how willing leaders are to take that walk, to step into those other shoes or other perspectives. And if they're not, if there's resistance there, does it still work?
To use your word, you have to start off with willing leaders. You cannot bring unwilling leaders to this process, because they'll spend all of their time trying to find ways why it wouldn't work and why it wouldn't work for them. So you have to start with, again, the area of influence. Those leaders who really feel that this could be of use to them, and they will then move it out. And so that's where you have to start. You have to start with the willing leaders. And once you have the willing leaders, or the willing leader, then it usually takes off from there.
I incredibly powerful and such great, I think, practical and pragmatic solutions for individuals and organizations to look at a challenge through a different lens, through a different way of considering how to begin to make shifts and changes in a really productive and, I think, highly self-aware context for those that engage. As we wrap up this episode, any final words of wisdom you want to offer to our audience? Any final thoughts before we close today?
No, I thank you for the opportunity to share our process. I invite people to reach out to us, individuals as well as organizations. I'm happy to work with individuals. And to everyone, it's become very famous line, it's not your fault, whether it is gaining weight or whatever. The famous line, it's not your fault. In a real sense, there is something that you can do about the ills of discrimination. You can empower yourself. And don't think about whose fault it is. Think about it in terms of, there is something that I can do that will improve my well-being, that will improve my motivation, and will improve the motivation of my workmates, my colleagues, my family members, etc. And think of it that way.
I think that's a wonderful bit of advice. And I think it lines up so much with what we say at Evolving to Exceptional, which is just that if we can always keep evolving, keep growing, keep looking for those opportunities to rewire our neural pathways, that we can create the lives and the experiences in our lives that we want to be having, that we can have more exceptional experiences on our life journey and throughout our lives. And that is what we hope for our listeners. And Dr. Douglas, thank you so much for coming on today. I think your work is phenomenal, and I highly recommend to our listeners that they reach out to you. Check this out. It's probably the most effective response I've heard in terms of addressing discrimination and an avenue for the individuals that find themselves in the situation to give them the empowerment to take action and to create a different outcome for themselves. So thank you so much for coming on today. And I so appreciate you. And to all of our listeners, I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day. And we'll be back again next week with another episode.
Okay. Thank you very much. And you have a good rest of the week.